We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. This is our morning talk program. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. This past spring, the governments of the United States and Russia agreed to restart talks aimed at reducing the nuclear arsenals of both countries. At the same time, both Russia and the United States maintain very large military forces, both nuclear and conventional. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the status of forces on both sides, talk about where things stand now involving Russia and the United States in terms of arms negotiations and arms reduction, what some people here in the United States in the defense business think about nuclear weapons and how they actually fit into our defense strategy, and we'll ask the question, how realistic is it to think about, as the president has said, think about a world that didn't have any nuclear weapons? Our guest for the conversation in this hour is Ivan Ulrich. He is the acting president of the Federation of American Scientists. In his work, he is interested in a number of things: nuclear testing, proliferation of nuclear weapons and nuclear materials, the structure of U.S. nuclear forces, and also the sizing of conventional military forces in the post-Cold War world. By his academic training, he's a chemist. He has a Ph.D. in chemistry from Princeton. He was a pre-doctoral research associate at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. He also conducted research in nuclear physics and taught in the physics department of the Technical University of Munich in Germany. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. We just ask that people be as brief as they can, and we do that so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible, and certainly we would like people to focus their questions on the subject that we're talking about, but certainly callers are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're welcome to call. Dr. Ulrich, hello.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. There are a number of things that I would like to try to talk about. There is something specific that I'd like to start with, and this was, I think, what started us thinking about having this conversation, and that is earlier this summer, maybe a few weeks ago, there was some reporting in the news about the fact that Russia had nuclear submarines, that is, nuclear-powered submarines, carrying missiles, patrolling off the Atlantic coast of the United States for the first time since the Cold War.
Yes.
And finally, when they were pressed, the Russian government, the Russian defense ministry said, yes, we're doing that, but this is just routine, that's just normal, it's nothing to be concerned about. Now, there is that. There's also the fact that we came across a piece talking about patrols by, similar sorts of patrols, by American submarines. These now go on primarily in the Pacific. They, according to at least this article, said that they're not doing this much in the Atlantic. But what is striking about it is that if you look at the amount of time spent patrolling on a per-boat basis, you see that it is undiminished from the level of the Cold War. In fact, apparently the time spent on patrol is actually longer than it was during the Cold War. So
yeah, that's work that's come out of the Federation here that we got that information through the Freedom of Information Act. Yes.
So this leads to the question now, why all of these years after the end of Cold War do we in the United States have 12 operational subs with over 1,000 nuclear warheads out on patrol? And why now recently has Russia decided apparently to increase the level of their patrols? And also apparently they have said that they intend to build a number of additional submarines. What's going on here?
Well, that's one of the things that where I can say that's a very good question. I wish I had a reasonable answer to that, and I don't. The fact is that we make a great deal about the reductions in the number of weapons, nuclear weapons, that we've had since the end of the Cold War, and a lot of weapons have been retired. But what's really astonishing is how, even with these smaller forces, how little has changed since the end of the Cold War. We still have missiles that are ready to launch at a moment's notice. We still have submarines that are constantly deployed. They're at sea off, well, we're presuming since they're moving into the Pacific. We do know whether our submarines are in the Pacific or the Atlantic, but we don't know in detail where they're going, but presumably they're off the coasts of China and Russia. They're, as you said, they have hundreds of missiles at any given moment. They have, which are armed with hundreds of nuclear warheads, which have yields anywhere from 10 to 50 times that of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima, that are literally 15, 20 minutes away from their targets in Russia and China. We still maintain this very high levels of alert, as they're called, the weapons forward deployed and ready to launch 24 hours a day, even though the threats of the Cold War have gone away. I think that largely this is because of an unthinking bureaucratic momentum. It's because military forces have missions that they are assigned and that they faithfully carry out. And the civilian leadership has not stepped in to change those missions. And the other thing that we get trapped in is that if you are a U.S. military planner, you look around the world at what are the potential threats to the United States, and you might think, oh, well, there's terrorism, or we might need to fight a war here, or we might need to fight a war there. But the only thing that could destroy the United States as a nation and as a society are Russian central nuclear forces. And the Russians have these forces left over the Cold War. We have nuclear forces to counter those nuclear forces, and our nuclear forces are left over after the Cold War. And so now 20 years after the Cold War, long after the reason that these weapons were built, they become self-justifying. We have the nuclear weapons because the Russians do, and the Russians have the nuclear weapons because we do. And we just don't seem to be able to break out of this feedback loop that is creating a danger for us every minute of every day.
And it seems in that we are not alone. The French, the British, China, they're all have programs to build new submarines and missile-carrying submarines.
Well, the submarines are something that many countries are interested in submarines, in part because some people, if a submarine is well built and well operated, it's very difficult to find. In fact, we can find Russian submarines because the Russian submarines are quite noisy. Moreover, it's difficult. It's a real technical challenge to operate a submarine fleet. The United States is able to do that on a very limited scale. The British and the French are able to do that. The Russians have ballistic missile submarines, but one reason that there was this news that these two submarines came down the east coast of the United States is because they have not sent their submarines out in years. In part, that's simply because of budget constraints, and in part because it's just technically very difficult. The Russians have had a lot of problems, technical problems, with keeping their submarines out at sea. Moreover, when their submarines do go out to sea, they're noisy, and our submarines can follow them, so it's not clear how useful that is. But the Chinese are building submarines, ballistic missile submarines, but we should make it clear this is, again, the Federation, the work done primarily by Hans Christensen using the Freedom of Information Act has shown that the Chinese have never sent their ballistic missile submarine out on an actual deployment. They sent it out for tests, but they've never sent it on a military deployment. Mm-hmm. So it's a real technical challenge. The Americans are extremely good at it. And other countries are not.
It's also, according to at least to one article that I read, India is apparently in negotiations to purchase one of these submarines from Russia.
Yes. This is The let me back up just a moment and make it clear that we can talk about nuclear weapons. We have to be clear that 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world today belong, even after the massive cuts from the Cold War, still belong to Russia and the United States. Mm-hmm. That Russia and the United States are the big nuclear powers, and everybody else put together is another 4 or 5%. So having said that, yes, the Indians and the Pakistanis seem to not be learning from the experience of the Americans and the Russians, or the Americans and the Soviet Union, and they are proceeding with a scaled down but still dangerous nuclear arms race. I won't even know if I call it an arms race. It just seems that both of them have programs to go forward with building new nuclear weapons, and the difference is that because they are next to one another, the flight times of their missiles are literally measured in 5-6 minutes, whereas at least during the standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States, you would have 30 or 40 minutes, which at the time was quite frightening, but it gives you a little time to think before you to detect an error or see, well, is this radar signal real? Did they really launch their missiles? We could ask those questions, but it's a potentially very dangerous, unstable situation between India and Pakistan, and it's worrying.
Yeah, particularly because of the record of hostility between the two countries. They have indeed fought wars with one another before.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to go back for a moment here to the United States and Russia, you said that of the nuclear weapons that exist in the world today, 95% of them are either in the hands of the United States or Russia. If you look at the levels now, the number of weapons now, and you compare that with the numbers at the end of the Cold War, can one say that there has been a significant reduction in the number of weapons?
Yes, there clearly has been a big reduction, almost a reductions of almost, more than half since the end of the Cold War, and more than three quarters from the peaks during the Cold War. Many people, especially during the Bush administration, the Department of Energy and the group within there that is responsible for nuclear weapons, what's called the National Nuclear Security Agency, would constantly pat themselves on the back that this was a demonstration that we were being aggressive about disarmament. And I think you have to put that in perspective, is that one of the things we have to keep in mind is that most of those reductions were not because of arms control agreements or political agreements, or it was because, moral outrage or anything like that. It was because most of the missions for nuclear weapons had gone away. We forget that during the 1950s and 60s, basically anything we could put a nuclear bomb on, we did, and the Russians did exactly the same thing. And so we had nuclear-armed torpedoes and nuclear depth charges and nuclear artillery pieces. And when I was I did my undergraduate work, as you mentioned, the University of Chicago, and when I arrived there in 1968, there were Nike Hercules anti-aircraft batteries where 63rd Street hit the lake. Mm-hmm. And these, you don't know which were which, but some of those were nuclear armed. So all of those missions have gone away. Most of the reductions in the numbers came about because nuclear weapons essentially became obsolete, not because of arms control agreements. And then even the changes since the end of the Cold War, we have to keep in mind that when you make a comparison to the Cold War, you're kind of using Cold War as a baseline. And I think that's wrong on two counts. One is the world is completely different from then, and so we shouldn't talk about reductions from the Cold War. We should talk about, okay, today is today. That was then, and this is now. How many weapons do we need? And the other thing is that I don't think that you can make any logical argument for how many weapons we had during the Cold War. The baseline from which you measure was irrational. We had far too many weapons during the Cold War, even for Cold War conditions, and so we could have made reductions of three quarters then and not endangered the nation's security at all.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ivan Ulrich. He is the acting president of the Federation of American Scientists. And we are talking this morning about, in part, about the status of Russian and American nuclear forces, about the effort to reduce nuclear weapons. The President of the United States and the President of Russia have agreed to move in that direction to reduce the number of weapons. There also is talk about restarting talks surrounding START, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, and also the Test Ban Treaty, things that would have to be approved by the Senate. We'll talk about that as well, because I think there are some people who think that there's not a great deal of, at least not a sense of urgency in Congress in moving in that direction. Any and all that questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Urbana to talk with here, line one. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hello. How are you, Dr. Aldridge? This is a really underreported idea in society, because after the Cold War supposedly ended, all these weapons were, as you said, decommissioned by lack of necessity. But there's still, the warheads are still there. Or they've disassembled the warheads. And could you talk about the when the U.S. Congress passed a bill back, I think, in the early 90s to help decommission Soviet weapons and store them? And also, the only reason nuclear weapons are probably even talked about now is because of maybe Pakistan falling into the insurgents, you know, becoming an Islamic fundamentalist state. And then you're right to talk about India and them having a, I don't think the Indians would stand for that. There might be another war over there. But the only thing I ever thought about nuclear weapons was just the immense overkill. I mean, metaphorically, I guess, but the fact that there were so many of these things out there. And you're right also that they're still on hair trigger launch, too. And that's like people don't even know that. But thank you. I really appreciate your work and your organization's work. It's very important, and I think more people need to know what's going on in this field. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I agree with you. The issue itself seems to have disappeared with the end of the Cold War. I think that many people think that nuclear weapons just sort of magically disappeared at the end of the Cold War, I guess the way we sent our battleships for scrap at the end of World War II. The situation is a little bit more realistic now, but the University of Maryland conducted a study now about 5 years ago, and they asked Americans how many nuclear weapons they thought that we needed, and the median answer was 100. And they asked them how many did they think that we actually had, and the median answer was 200. And this was at a time when we had almost 9,000 nuclear weapons. If you poll people today, they're a little bit more realistic, but not much more. You mentioned this question of dismantlement, and it is true that a lot of nuclear weapons are taken out of the so-called stockpile. They're sent from the Department of Defense, which controls them on a day-to-day basis, and sent back to the Department of Energy, which maintains them and designs new weapons and does all that sort of work. And dismantling the nuclear weapons is work that has to be done very carefully. It's very slow, and so there is a huge stockpile of weapons. We have over 4,000 weapons that are awaiting dismantlement, that officially are not in the stockpile and don't belong to the Department of Defense, but are now under control of the Department of Energy. But if we, and the Russians have a similar number, and if you wanted, you could put those by just replacing batteries and other parts, you could put them back in the stockpile. And finally, I think that your point that we are overlooking this is I think it's just a question that this is what worries me the most, is that we have a danger all the time from Russian nuclear weapons, just like they have a danger from U.S. nuclear weapons. But after it goes on for decades after decades, people just don't see it anymore. It becomes like the wallpaper or the background. And it just doesn't get the attention that it deserves. I believe that politically we have a very short window here with the makeup of the Congress and the president, who seems to be dedicated to this, that we might actually be able to do something dramatic and radical, but only if we can get political support from certain key players. If you're, I'm guessing that you have many listeners in both Indiana and Illinois, and you should make it aware that to your senators that you are concerned about this.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller, listener, someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, I was qualified to work on nuclear submarines, went through nuclear prototype qualifications, and I'm also aware of some of the possibilities and actualities of warships and aircraft to carry nuclear weapons. I think I'm probably still not allowed to say which ones, but that's not terribly important at this point. That was years ago. My question is unilateral disarmament, and I'm not just talking about the United States, but any single country possessing nuclear weapons, is unilateral disarmament possible, certainly from the physical sense it is? Is it possible from the political sense? I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, if you ask the question in general, I can definitely say yes, because there have been countries who have done that. First of all, South Africa had a nuclear weapons program and built 10 to 12 nuclear weapons. And when they went to majority government, they during that process, they got rid of their nuclear weapons. They unilaterally disarmed. Also, you have to remember that when the Soviet Union was a nuclear power and Soviet nuclear weapons were deployed in Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus. And so when the Soviet Union broke up into these independent countries, there were nuclear weapons in outside of Russia. And those, the three non-Russian countries that, that had these newly formed countries that had nuclear weapons, made a decision to get rid of them and send them back to Russia. And so they could have, Ukraine, for example, could have made the decision, nope, the nuclear weapons here that are in Ukraine, they now belong to Ukraine, and we're going to keep them. And they decided not to do that. So there have been at least four cases where countries have unilaterally given up nuclear weapons. Now, whether the United States or Russia or some of the more established nuclear powers would do that, I agree. That would be, politically, that would be very difficult. Even President Obama, who has always puts a caveat on his efforts to reduce nuclear weapons, he says that we will have them as long as other countries do. And I frankly think that that's a bit, that's not supportable. If North Korea has one nuclear bomb, that's not a reason for us to have nuclear bombs. So politically it's going to be very difficult, but it's not impossible.
I understand, and it seems to me, because I certainly agree with you, that the term overkill is both tragic but true, scientifically, mutually assured destruction idea. But it seems to me to be part of the failure of human nature, because no human is perfect, that we're always looking to see, do I have something at least big as my neighbor? Thank you very much, and enjoy your comments.
All right, thank you. We'll go next to Chicago for another caller on our toll-free line, line four. Hello?
On a peaceful note, I'd heard many, many years ago that at one time Hawaii suffered a damaging blow to their energy productions, and they installed a nuclear submarine to hook up into their grid and supply the energy. I was wondering if you had ever heard of anything about a peaceful use of nuclear subs in that manner.
Yes, this has. Well, I have to admit, I cannot remember the details of that, but that happened. That the a nuclear submarine has a nuclear reactor on it. The nuclear reactor runs a turbine, but it doesn't run the blades of the propeller directly. It produces electricity, and then the ship's propellers are run off of electric motors. So you can run cables off of that. And I do remember that was back in the 50s or 60s or sometime, a long time ago, and I can't remember the details of that. But, yes, I do remember seeing photographs of that. I would not recommend that. If you want to build if you want to use nuclear power, you're better off to decommission the nuclear subs. And if there's a whole debate about whether nuclear power is a good idea or not, but if you did want to build nuclear power plants, you're better to build them on land. It's cheaper and more reliable. And nuclear submarines, the nuclear power plants on them are not, they're built for safety and reliability and not for high performance. They're not as, they don't produce as much energy per sort of cubic foot that they could, because they've put enormous emphasis on having them never ever break down. So I wouldn't recommend that as a solution, but I do remember your story. Yeah.
Again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Ivan Ulrich. He is the acting president of the Federation of American Scientists. And we're talking here this morning about, at least in part, about the status of Russian and American nuclear forces and about the effort to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons around the world. Right now, in Washington, people in the Pentagon and in the Department of Defense are involved in something called the Nuclear Posture Review. This is something that's required by Congress, and it looks at nuclear strategy and forces, and it's supposed to be completed by the end of the year. I am curious about now, what is the defined role in our defense strategy for nuclear weapons, and is that likely to change?
The defined role now, our official document, what's written down on paper, is what's still left over from the Bush administration. Now, if you ever, you can't use nuclear weapons without, unlike other military forces, nuclear weapons are one of those things that, weapon by weapon, you need to have approval by the President of the United States. And so, in fact, we have a different president, so how they'd be used is different. But what's actually written down is what is still left over from the Bush administration. And the nuclear doctrine of the Bush administration, we have well documented. You should, there's a, on our website, FAS.org, there's something called Global Strike, which is a review of the development of nuclear doctrine during the Bush administration. And I think that most Americans, if they knew what our doctrine, what our policy was toward nuclear weapons, would be both surprised and frightened. At the end of the Cold War, people sort of realized, well, nuclear weapons, they seem to be very, very important, but we couldn't really use them because we had nuclear weapons, and anything that we could use them for. The Soviets also had nuclear weapons, and so they're immensely powerful. They're important, but they seemed to actually just checkmate each other, and at the end, you were left with nothing. With the end of the Cold War, there are two routes you could have gone. You could have said, whoa, that was a close shave. Let's, now that the Cold War is over, let's get rid of all these things. Or you could say, they're no longer checkmated. Now maybe we have uses for nuclear weapons, and we can be more aggressive about their use because we don't have to worry about their being checkmated by the Soviet Union or now Russia. And the Bush administration went some distance in that direction. There was some mixing of conventional and nuclear roles. They widened the range of targets that would be considered for nuclear weapons, the range of countries. And so, for example, you didn't have to be a nuclear country to be on our nuclear list. You might be thinking about building chemical weapons or biological weapons, and that would put you on our nuclear target list. So that is what the status was at the end of the Bush administration. Now, the Nuclear Posture Review is supposed to review that and, in theory, start with a clean sheet of paper. This study that's going on right now and is supposed to be done in December. Most people don't think it will be quite on time, but it'll be soon after then. This is looking at the fundamental doctrine for why do we have nuclear weapons? What are they for? When are we going to use them, et cetera? What kind of targets are we going to use for them? And this is key because this will set the tone for everything else. What kind of arms control agreements do we want to have? And what I'm afraid of is that the people in the State Department, Defense Department, Department of Energy who are working on this nuclear posture review do not have the revolutionary vision that the president has, and that
we have to be very careful that when this goes and starts churning through the bureaucracy, that everyone who's working on this is constantly reminded of what the president's really hopeful and very dramatically different, you know, genuinely new vision for nuclear weapons is.
Well, just very, very quickly, and I promise I have some other callers I want to get to, that the two presidents, Mr. Medvedev and Mr. Obama, of Russia and the U.S., have talked about a number of things, and that is the United States ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, starting up SALT again, also strengthening of the NPT. And these sorts of things here on our side would require action by the Congress. And as I read about it, Congress's plate is full, and there doesn't seem to be a great deal of urgency on the part of the Congress to move on these things, and certainly not before the end of the year.
That is probably true. I mean, the Congress does seem to be able to only focus on one big thing at a time, and obviously that thing at beginning in the administration was the economy, and now it's health care, and it seems that no one is paying attention to things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. There certainly are people working in the background who are on the appropriate committees and such that are concerned about this, but it doesn't break through into the news cycle. It might very well be that Congress, and specifically in the case of treaties, which have to be ratified by the Senate, that the Senate will not be able to handle these things until 2010. The urgent thing is that the START treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, is going to expire in December, and people aren't so concerned about the limits on the numbers because it's not as though the next day we and the Russians are going to start building new nuclear weapons. But there's a lot of provisions for verification of that. For each side uses techniques for checking up on the other, and there are provisions for having inspectors go back and forth and how we can handle the data and all these things, and we don't want those to expire. And so there's this treaty that the two presidents have agreed on in outline, which they're calling the START follow-on, is sort of a placeholder to keep all those verification procedures in place. And the idea is that, well, once that's done, then they can focus on another treaty, which I swear is called the START follow-on, and that will be the real arms control treaty, and that will discuss reductions, because there are no real reductions in the START follow-on other than what we already have agreed to today.
All right, let's talk with some of the callers. Next up in line is Effingham, line one. Hello.
Two quick things. President Bush II and his fence, I think it was a nuclear fence in Poland, and if I were a Russian, I would have not been very comfortable. And if we go back to 1963, when the Russians were going to build nuclear bases in Cuba, and all of that erupted, and the agreement that the U.S. would not ring Russia again in Western Europe. Do you have any comment about those things? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, there's the we have to be aware that when we're negotiating these treaties with the Russians, that you know that the Russians see the world very differently than we do. You know, we have on our borders Mexico and Canada, and they have on their border China, you know, another nuclear power. And, you know, relations between Russia and China seem to be going well now, but the fact is they have, you know, been quite hostile in the past, and maybe they're thinking they'll be hostile in the future. And the Chinese are a formidable military power and also a nuclear power. I think that the Obama administration is very much aware of this. There are questions about, for example, this placement of a ballistic missile bases, radars in the Czech Republic, and missiles in Poland, and apparently the administration is is backing away from that now. I believe that we have an opportunity to work much more closely with the Russians to remove this mutual threat that we hold against each other. And independent of a lot of other causes of tension that occur between us and Russia, I'm not trying to be an apologist for Russia. We have legitimate arguments with Russia. They have some legitimate complaints about us. We're never going to, I don't think that we and the Russians are going to be bosom buddies, but even with some major disagreements, we can agree that we should reduce this nuclear threat against each other, which serves no purpose and just is a hangover from the Cold War.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go on and talk next with someone in Champaign and on line number two. Hello.
Hi. I just came in on the conversation when you were talking, I believe, about the danger posed by having both Pakistan and India, arch rivals, nuclear nations. And I don't know if this has come up, but has anyone talked about the nuclear capabilities of Israel? Has that come up, David?
No. No.
I'm going to ask you the questions that I had on my mind. You raised them. One, does Israel have nuclear weapons? Why do they have them? What do they plan to use them for? And what would be the targets? And sort of tying that in, even though I never want to see Iran with a nuclear weapon in the Middle East, however, can you justify in terms of security reasons why and prestige reasons why Iran might want a nuclear weapon, especially if Israel has a nuclear weapon? Or I'll wait for you to tell me if Israel has nuclear weapons. Thank you.
Yes.
Sure. Israel is a peculiar case because officially the government neither confirms nor denies that they have nuclear weapons. If you ask an Israeli diplomat, do you have nuclear weapons, he'll say no comment. Having said that, everybody inside and outside Israel believes that Israel has some nuclear force that can be delivered either by aircraft or by their missiles, Jericho missiles. The number of weapons estimated ranges from a low of 80 to a high of about 200. Very little is known about the Israeli nuclear doctrine, because if the government doesn't admit that they have nuclear weapons, they obviously can't discuss publicly what their nuclear doctrine is. The way we do, and to a certain extent, the Russians and the Chinese, the British and the French, they know, you know, everyone, they say they have nuclear weapons, and so they can say, well, this is what we're going to use them now for. That debate does not take place in public in Israel. Presumably somebody somewhere is worrying about that, but it isn't discussed in their parliament. It isn't discussed in their press. So we don't really know what their thinking is about nuclear weapons. Presumably, they feel as though that there is an existential threat, a threat to the very existence of Israel from their neighbors and also from more distant countries like Iran, and that this is sort of their ace in the hole that they will have for the ultimate deterrent against the destruction of Israel. But you bring up an interesting point. Whenever you talk about arms control negotiations and reducing the number of nuclear weapons in the world, well, where are the nuclear weapons? They're in Russia and the United States. And so we talk about how we can get the Russians and the United States to reduce the number of weapons. But then you're going to have to bring in the Chinese, and then you're going to have to bring in the British and the French, and then eventually the Indians and the Pakistanis, and eventually the Israelis. And it's going to get hard toward the end, I admit. It's going to be very difficult, because each of these countries are not looking at their security in terms of a global nuclear threat, but very locally, and they're looking across the fence at their neighbors, and their neighbors look pretty scary in a lot of cases.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we will move on again and talk with someone in Urbana on line three. Hello.
Hi. This is a bit more of an anecdote. I spent the latter part of 1988 and the early part of 89 on SSN 613. working as a battle station helmsman, and I spent that whole Westpac sleeping about 6 feet away from two sub-rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, an experience like that, lying awake a few nights wondering about your own existence and why you're doing something like that, that'll sure make you a peace-loving person. After I got out of the Navy in 92, I went straight to art school. Didn't want to have anything to do with the rest of that stuff.
Yeah.
So,
well,
I think some of our leaders had a similar experience. Maybe they would feel a little bit differently.
Yeah. That's an interesting story with the surface Navy now has removed all of its nuclear weapons. And, in fact, surface navies around the world typically do not deploy nuclear weapons. We still deploy nuclear weapons on submarines. And what he was the caller was describing was not the big submarines, so-called boomers, the ballistic missile submarines that carry the big missiles with warheads on top. But what people don't realize is that our tactical submarines are sometimes armed with nuclear weapons, either cruise missiles that carry nuclear warheads, or other kinds of things like nuclear-armed torpedoes or these combinations. They fly out for some distance as a missile and then reenter the water and act as a torpedo. And those would have nuclear weapons on them still. And the Navy is always very cautious about saying exactly which ships have nuclear weapons and what don't, even types of ships. So we don't know. Presumably the deployments of these tactical nuclear weapons is much reduced, but in principle we can still put nuclear weapons out even on our tactical submarines.
This and I appreciate the comment of the caller, and I think this gives me the opportunity to ask a question about tactical weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, because
mm-hmm.
what we have been talking about, the efforts to improve our arms control negotiations and move to limit weapons, the weapons there we're talking about are strategic weapons,
yeah.
and these are the big ones that you would use to target a city. Maybe you might use to target some very large military target. There are also a lot of smaller weapons that were designed for battlefield use, and these things are not, they're not a part of the kind of arms control negotiations we have been talking about. I'm not sure that there has been much in the way of arms control negotiations involving tactical nuclear weapons at all.
No, that is a problem and will be a growing problem as the number of strategic weapons goes down and the relative importance of these other weapons will increase, of course. One thing that we should make clear is, and it's something of an artificial distinction. We talk about strategic and tactical nuclear weapons, and basically that's a question about the range of the weapons. In general, the strategic weapons were also more powerful, but they basically, not to get into numbers, but the strategic weapons are the ones that could go from the United States over to Russia, these long-range missiles or the bombers and things, and the ones that could come from Russia to the United States. And tactical weapons are shorter range. We used to have even tactical weapons that would include nuclear artillery. Okay, there was a Davy Crockett rocket that you could launch off the back of a Jeep. It was about, 6-8 feet long and had a small nuclear warhead on it. In general, the tactical nuclear warheads are less powerful than the strategic warheads, but we have to be very careful when we talk about nuclear weapons to constantly be reminding ourselves of the reality of these things. It's like saying that a Goliath beetle is a very large insect, and a dolphin is a small whale, okay? But, all of these things are huge by conventional standards. The weapon that destroyed Hiroshima was probably 15 to 18 kilotons. That's thousands of tons of TNT. And even tactical nuclear weapons, some of them, like we have bombs in Europe now, that are 10 times more powerful, but are called tactical nuclear weapons.
Hmm.
So some of the tactical nuclear weapons can be small, quite small by nuclear standards, but others can be devastating enough to destroy an entire city.
Hmm.
And we do have some. We don't have many left. We've got rid of our nuclear artillery, for example, and those other things. We still have air-delivered bombs in Europe, about 500 of these weapons, B-61 bombs. About 200 of them are deployed in Europe. The Russians have much larger numbers, and we're not quite clear on how many they have. They are, of course, concerned about facing the Chinese across their border. And your argument, you said that we haven't addressed these in arms control negotiations. That's largely true, certainly for the smaller things we've not, except that we do have the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which completely banned weapons that had ranges between 500 and 5,000 kilometers that were sort of in between the strategic and the tactical ranges. And so those are no longer allowed, at least by the United States and Russia, that are party to that treaty.
You know, I guess I always, when I heard the stories of these small nuclear munitions, given that conventional weapons are seen to be powerful enough, I don't understand why anybody would have thought that something like that would have even been useful, why you would even decide you would need to have one.
Well, in fact, they came into their own before we had the conventional weapons that were accurate enough to do it. And that is what you've been seeing with this, as I was discussing earlier. The big reductions in the numbers of weapons have come because of eliminating these small tactical nuclear weapons that were going to be used in Europe, for example, in tank battles and things like that. And the reason that they were retired is because we developed precision-guided conventional munitions. It's very difficult to destroy something as tough as a tank, if with a conventional weapon, unless you're very accurate. A 500-pound bomb, if it just lands 30, 40 feet away, if the tank is all buttoned up, it won't necessarily destroy it. But if you hit it, you hit the tank, you can destroy it with a charge of tens of kilograms of explosive. So it's these developments in sensors and computers that allowed these precision-guided munitions to hit, pinpoint accuracy on their targets. That is much preferable from a military point of view. One of the things we have to keep in mind is that the military is not great fans of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are terrible pain. All the security you have to have and the special training, if they can get rid of them, they would prefer to in general. There was no one in the Army who was sad to see the last of the nuclear weapons go. And they were replaced by these advanced conventional munitions.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller here. I want to make sure that we get in Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hi there. The nuclear waste issue, they come up with about how many, millions of years or whatever it is, thousands of years it takes, and they have to bury it so deep. Mm-hmm. What kind of environmental impact is there for these people who are like the guy who spoke earlier, these people who have been around these airplanes and sites where where they have these active weapons? Isn't there any problems with leakage or any kind of radiation that would be cumulative?
There have been in the past some exposures of people who have been working with nuclear weapons. In the United States, we've been, in general, very, very careful with that. The Russians' stories have come out from Russia that they have been far less careful. But the nuclear weapons themselves, surprisingly, especially American weapons, don't emit much radiation. If they're,
if there are people who are on duty around these things, for 6 months or whatever on a regular basis, is that still enough to affect them long term?
I don't believe
studies
so.
Like that. They probably don't do studies like that.
No, they don't do studies. And also, it isn't like you typically don't sit next to your nuclear bomb for 6 months at a time. They'll be in places where you need to go and check on them. People who are around nuclear weapons or any kind of radiation source wear radiation monitors. I did my graduate work in nuclear physics, and I'm sure that doing my PhD dissertation, I got a lot more radiation exposure than people who work around nuclear weapons. If you're careful, that's not the issue. The issue is if they get out of hand and somebody makes a mistake and we use them. There is some danger with the
people who have worked in uranium mines and such. They've showed increased cancer rates there, but not with working with the weapons themselves.
When they're
assembled and everything, as you know, the military personnel, yeah. Not the people who are building them and such.
We're at the point we're going to have to finish very quickly. Do you think that it is realistic, as the president has said, to think that we could get to a point where effectively there are no nuclear weapons?
Yes, I think that we can do that. It will take it'll take some imagination. It'll take a little bit of boldness. But it can be. It needs people to think in a new way. But it is not only possible, but I think that not just the world would be safer, but we, the United States as a nation would be safer in a world that had no nuclear weapons, and we can get there. I think that that's possible.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Ivan Ulrich. He is the acting president, Dr. Ivan Ulrich, acting president of the Federation of American Scientists. And if you'd like to find out more about the organization, read on this issue, you can go to their website, which is fas.org. And Dr. Ulrich, thank you very much.
All right. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Champaign Park District. The Champaign Park District and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony present Symphony at Sunset to kick off the 50th anniversary of the CU Symphony at Dodds Park on Saturday, September 19th. There'll be an instrument petting zoo, entertainment, and food vendors before the concert at 7 p.m. More information available at champaignparkdistrict.com. That's it for us on Focus for today, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be food writer Andrew Koh. We'll talk with him about his book, Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices and how they're faring in Kansas City and in Chicago. September wheat in Kansas City is trading at 483 and a quarter, down 8. December 498, down 9. Chicago September wheat, 448 and a quarter, down 8 and 3 quarters. December, 475 and 3 quarters, down 10. September corn, 307 and 3 quarters, down 5 and a half. December, 312 and a half, down 6 and 3 quarters. March, 325 and 3 quarters, down 6 and 3 quarters. May, 335, down 6 and a half. September soybeans, 977 and 3 quarters, down 31 and a half. November, 936 and a quarter, down 14 and 3 quarters. January, 941 and a quarter, down 13. March, 941 and 3 quarters, down 12 and a quarter. May, 939 and a half, down 12. September meal, 322.50, down 26. September oil, 33.84, down 28. At the Merck, October live cattle, 87.07 and a half, up 30. December, 87 even, up 20. September feeder cattle, 98.60, unchanged. October, 98.70. That is up 20. October lean hogs, 49.50, up 67 and a half. Outside markets, October crude, 68.45, up 40. The U.S. dollar, 78.42, up 4. The CRB index, 249.21, down 42. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 17. The NASDAQ is up 6. The